you got an empty chair next to you, raise your hand, will you, so we can maybe get some folks over here to have a seat? Good evening, everyone. Did we get the cue back there? Okay. Let's try that again. I'm not getting any enthusiasm out here. Good evening, everyone. Oh, okay. That's better. Those of you who don't know me, my name is Tony Ferrara. I'm the mayor here in Arroyo Grande, and I apologize for the cramped quarters here, but Zone 11A does not have a budget, and this was free. So that's why we're here. If we do run out of chairs and folks are standing in the back of the room between myself and Jim Bergman, we'll bring out some additional chairs for you. I'm going to try and hang in as long as I can. You know you're having a bad day when you really need a cough drop, and you start peeling it, and the paper sticks to half of it, and you can't get it off. That's where we're at. We have a full agenda tonight, a lot of information. For those of you who have not been in this facility before, the restroom is through the conference room, and I would advise you to plan ahead because it's a one-holer, and we've got a lot of people here. So if you're even thinking about going to the restroom, I would go over there and get in the queue. So that's the only...
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Linda Chipping. I'm president of the Coastal San Luis Resource Conservation District, and I've been a participant with the 11A Task Force. Before I get into the outline for the evening, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Mayor Ferrara for making this facility available, and also the City of Arroyo Grande for letting us do a televised broadcast of this meeting. Those people that aren't able to come tonight will be able to see it on television. I'd also like to thank the County Board of Supervisors, the California State Coastal Conservancy, and the California Department of Parks and Rec, who provided the funding for the study, which you will be hearing more about later in the evening. I'd like to thank Steph Wald, who is going to be facilitating our evening progress, and Julie Thomas, who has been and will continue to coordinate many of the activities for Zone 11A. There is a change in this evening's program. We had originally sent out a flyer which indicated that we would do the presentation to describe the draft study, which is the Arroyo Grande Creek Erosion Sedimentation and Flood Control Alternative Study first, and then a panel discussion on the efforts that are going on in the Flood Control Zone 11A. We're switching that. We're flipping it. So we're going to do the panel discussion first, then take our break, and then come back and do the Mr. Dvorsky will be doing the presentation on what his findings were in the study. So for those of you that, if that is going to be an inconvenience for any of you, we apologize for that, but there was a feeling that the majority of you were sort of anxious to hear what Zone 11A had been doing, and that you may find the evening getting long if you needed to stay for that at the end. And with that, I'll turn it over to Steph.
Thanks, Linda. My name is Steph Wald, and I work for Central Coast Salmon Enhancement as Watershed Projects Manager, and I'm happy to be here this evening to lead you in a variety of activities that will hopefully help you become more comfortable with what's been underway now in Zone 11A. I'll be introducing the panelists in just a moment, but I wanted to let you know that this has become a truly local effort, and you being here tonight is testament to that. We have residents, agencies, elected officials, and nonprofits who are helping keep the local control that you'll hear about tonight, and also keeping the cost down so that it's an affordable plan. I want to remind you, Kabara, the chair of the Zone 11A, and Tony Ferrara, who you met already. And if you don't know Norm, you will by the end of the evening. Norm Getty is a local resident. He's really stepped up, and he'll be talking about the 218 vote tonight. And then Linda Chipping, who you just met, will be talking a little bit about comparing the local plan and the DWR situation. And then John Dvorsky, who's been working on the flood alternative study, will be talking as well. I wanted to also request that this is a little different than the public forum that we had in April, where people were spilling out of the doors and sitting outside by the barbecue, where we took your questions and wrote them up on flip charts. This time we're requesting that when you have a question or a comment, that you use the comment cards that were on the front table, and I have some more here with me. We hope that that will move things forward expeditiously, and I'll be collecting those cards as we go along. And Julie will as well. So if you have a question, please jot it down. If you need something to write with, let us know. We'll bring something over to you. And we'll collect those cards. We'll read through them and figure out if you don't know who to address it to, we'll figure out who to hand the card to and get your needs met. So my job basically is to introduce those panel members and to tell you about the cards. And so Gary's going to get us started off by talking a little bit about the Zone 11A. And do you need this or do you use that?
Does this work?
I don't know.
Does it work? Okay. Hi, my name is Gary Kubara. I'm the chair of the Zone 11A Advisory Committee. There are seven members in the Advisory Committee, and they're listed up on the screen, but I'll also name them off. Vicki Cardoza, Wilfred Deshays, Glenda Guyton, Stan Ikeda, Mark Overdoon, John Taylor, and myself. Our group meets approximately once a month to discuss what's happening in the zone and make recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. Tonight, there's four items that are going to follow mine. We have a very high interest in all these, but the advisory committee has a good understanding of the Zone 11A itself. We live in the zone, or we work in the zone, or we have ground in the zone. All the people that are on the advisory committee, but the advisory but we are lacking in some technical aspects, things like understanding how the political names are up there also. I won't go list them all, but there are different groups and organizations involved. I'll list them. They include San Luis Obispo Coastal Resource San Luis Coastal Resource Conservation District, RCD, Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, Oceano Community Service District, OCSD, local homeowners, agriculturalists, sanitation district representatives, along with county and Arroyo Grande City input. All these people have come together and been working very hard on this subject. Since the figures on the Swanson study have been available, we've been meeting much more often, probably averaging once a week to sometimes three times a week. And that doesn't include the daily emails we get. I'm becoming much more proficient in use of the computer. Not to mention the amount of energy that everybody's putting into this. There's a lot of hours going in, and I like to thank those people who are doing it, especially Mayor Ferrara for all his time. He's really helped a lot. As the chart shows, we've been meeting with county people, public works, and others to get this thing going, and they have been very helpful. They've been addressing our concerns. We've been telling them what we need, and they've been either getting it for us or telling us how to get it. So it is very, very nice. There is creek cleanup. excuse me. That's just happening. As far as actually taking trash out. There was a cleanup day, and there was goats going through the creek from the Valley Road Bridge in the Los Barrios Channel down to the Railroad Bridge in Arroyo Grande Channel. Also, there's willow cleaning that started from around the airport or the sanitation district that's up to between the Highway 1 bridge and the 22nd Street bridge. Yeah. Next.
Test. I'm going to spend just a few minutes and talk to you about the local control option. As many of you know, if you were at that board meeting, there was a lot of discussion about what configuration a local control entity would take. And for those of you who don't understand what local control means, it means an alternative to turning this over to the state. In other words, there has to be some oversight body, if you will, that can oversee the scope of work, can develop that scope of work, can do the project management. There needs to be someone who will, for all intents and purposes, be the bank if we're successful, and I know we're going to be with the 2018 election. When those assessments start coming in, we want to turn them around and put them to work. We need an organizational entity that can, in fact, perform those tasks as well and many others. So there was a move afoot, and the subject may still come up about forming a separate legal entity, and I want to talk a little bit about that. What we're proposing right now as an interim measure is what you see up on the screen, and I should indicate to you that we went to a lot of trouble preparing these note-taking handouts, so I hope you use them. And so find the slide, and if you want to jot a couple of notes opposite the slide, feel free to do so. The organizations that you see inside of the circle here are virtually, they are organizations who are either directly involved or interested to some degree, because to some degree they are stakeholders in a successful flood management program in Zone 11A. Our philosophy, and when I say our philosophy, I'm talking specifically about the task force and what we recommend to the advisory committee and what we are ultimately going to recommend to the Board of Supervisors when we give our update very soon, is that since these organizations are already working together, then we have to question whether or not forming a separate legal entity is needed, at least at this juncture. Our position is that since we do have these entities working together, that perhaps if we formalize it a little bit more, then we can use this kind of patience. And here they are again, is that in the near future we form, hopefully by an MOU of sorts, this organization to do that interim management. Now, when I say we're working together, I'll give you an idea. City of Arroyo Grande and the county are already working on the upper watershed issues, and the next slide is going to depict that, so I'll come back to that issue. The sanitation district, there's a lot that's still in process right now, but the sanitation district has made a commitment to step up to the table, and before we had not. So that's sort of my other hat. I wear that hat as a board member in the San District as well. The San District is in Zone 11A. More details to follow. We're still working out the fine points. But the bottom line is there's a sense of cooperation on the part of the San District to help out. That wasn't there before. Salmon Enhancement, Steph's group, where are you? There you are. Steph's group has been right along with us. They were very much involved in sponsoring creek cleanup days and the activity that was ascribed to you about the goats and the California Conservation Corps and all of the rest of that activity and getting volunteers energized and organized to come out and help. So they've been helping as well. And the RCD has stepped up huge. Linda and Julie and her folks in doing this kind of interim project management, which we hope will carry over in this new proposed organization. So that's a little bit about the work activity that's already underway. It's already underway because of the cooperation and the capability of organizations that already exist. And so our position is, why create a new legal entity when, if we have a sense of cooperation and focus among agencies that are already here on the ground and working, let's give that a shot first and see how it works. It's a lot cheaper, a lot quicker to put into action. I want to talk a little bit about the upper watershed issues, because this segues into Norm's presentation, which is going to follow in a moment. Excuse me. Norm may be on now. There's been a lot of talk about the issues that are happening upstream from Zone 11A. We acknowledge, we here in Arroyo Grande have acknowledged that, and those of you who have been to other meetings and have heard me speak to this issue, then the continuing problems that you see downstream with siltation and all of the other problems that wash down from up above, if we can stabilize what's happening up here, which we are now working towards doing, then what you have is a more stable situation, a more manageable situation down below. Some of the things that we've done here in the city that I think, and was not an easy task, and our community development stepped up to the plate. I don't know if you follow our council meetings at all on Channel 20. A couple of meetings ago, we put in place an urgency ordinance that put a moratorium on any new development in and around the setback to the creek, all of our creek systems. So the impact of development, and there'll probably be more discussion about that a little bit later on, the impact of development is being monitored much more closely now than it was before. We are starting to put in flood protection and creek maintenance into our capital improvement goals, and we're we're also focusing on that would be great. Thank you so much. It's a Ricola, and I don't know if you heard about the contest, but I'm not giving you $1 million for this. Thank you so much. Where was I? I cued Norm. Okay, the urgency ordinance that is in place now, we're going to be studying our setback policy. We're taking this serious. I wish we would have done it a long time ago. We're doing it now. And again, with a view towards stabilizing the issue up here. The other thing I began to mention with the capital improvement program, that's focusing hopefully on what we anticipate will be a successful sales tax initiative. If that sales tax initiative passes, that will give us an opportunity for to leverage money long term, and it's going to go for infrastructure to include ensuring that our creek system is better maintained in the future. That's something we've never done. We're going to do it now. The other thing that we had an opportunity to meet with Cacho and Vicky and Jerry Lenthal, our public works met here, right here at this desk. County Public Works met as well. We made a commitment to deal, to work together, because they complaining this issue here is to indicate to you that this process that we have in place right now, these agreements that we have in place, this commitment that we have in place, we think will begin to turn the tide in terms of causing you folks downstream problems. Again, with a view towards stabilizing things up here. If we stabilize up here, you guys will stabilize downstream. So that's working. A lot of effort has gone into it. We're going to continue to march with it, and we expect good results. And with that, I'm going to turn it over.
Thank you very much. Give Tony a hand, please. It's my hope that you will begin to feel a sense of not comfort, but encouragement. My first meeting to Zone 11A activity, I walked out feeling very hopeless. I felt like there was not much hope. I saw a locomotive coming at me, pell-mell at speed that I couldn't deal with, and I had no defense for that. Having the advantage of participating in these meetings has allowed me the privilege of gaining hope, of seeing some of the inside workings and realizing that it's not a hopeless situation. It is, however, a very complicated situation. And one of the things I think that happens to us is that we are so used to pushing the control button and changing the scene. We're used to speed dialing. We're used to all of the conveniences in our modern life that when we get into the process of working together, developing solutions for problems, solving problems, raising money, doing things of that sort, the pace of those things all slows down. It kind of goes into a time warp, and it feels as though there's nothing happening. I'm hopeful that you get enough information tonight that you walk away with a feeling that, yes, indeed, something has been accomplished. And I would point you to the June 14th meeting at the Board of Supervisors. And this will all lead in and tie into Prop 218 information. June 14th was a turning point for us. The locomotive got instructions to, whoa, 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 slow down. In fact, that locomotive got stopped for an entire year. That allows us as a local group, local volunteers, local experts, wanting something to be done. We've got that study in draft now. And I'd underline the word draft because there are revisions and changes and working of it. And the purpose of these meetings is to get it out to the public. And there will be questions that will generate from hearing information. Doesn't mean it's cast in concrete. And the segue I'd like to make tonight is that the Swanson study proposes a group of costs for a variety of projects. That's one snapshot view. Tony speaks of it as a menu, a list of things that we can see that could be done, need to be done, ought to be done, and puts an estimated price on it. The value of that is that on a local basis, we get to pick and choose, and we get to develop the strategy using that information and having that cost information and those cost estimates as a guide. It's not a budget. We're not here tonight to talk about funding those numbers. Okay, as I think it's very important for you to walk away with that knowledge and information. We're also not here tonight to fund the Department of Water Resources projections. Okay, and I don't want to step on that because that's part of Linda's stuff. She's sitting over here nudging me. But what I hope you gain is the sense that we do have direction and we do have a working plan that is a plan in progress. It's a work in progress. Proposition 218 is my topic. I was going to wear a black hat, and I thought, no, that won't be good. When we begin to talk about taxes and costs and raising money and paying our way, it's a very touchy subject, and people get very antsy because we're all stressed with financial cost increases. Everybody's faced with it. We're all suffering from it. Proposition 218 is a great ally, whether or not you look at it that way or not. But in 1996, there was an amendment to our state constitution which says no longer can any agency, government agency or taxing agency, assess for services or for a project without a voter approval. And that, in the past, the voter didn't have much option. We were powerless. You were on the railroad track and the locomotive was coming right at you. But with Prop 218 passed in 1996, it turned that around, so it gives those assessments on single-family dwelling might be $5 a year. It's not enough money. Early on, we realized that we weren't collecting enough money to care for the channel. There's a whole long story about it, and we can point backward. That was then. This is now. We need more money to take care of the channel. An assessment is placed on the property. It's collected on the regular tax bill. And it's not a tax or an assessment based on the property value. There's a different basis for that. Okay? It requires that we go out to an engineer. The engineer looks at the benefits and determines the distribution and determines the formula to spread the cost of the project to those people that will receive the benefit. It's important to understand that these are specific benefits. Prop 218 says that there must be a determination of the special benefit to the property. It can't be just a general thing that, well, because you got a road, everybody enjoys the road. No, rather, this is a specific flood protection project for Zone 1-1A. So the engineer will make a determination. He'll come up with a formula, and then that formula will be spread on a proportionate basis to the people that are affected. And the rule of Prop 218, another good feature, is that it must be proportional. In other words, just because somebody decides they want to charge you X dollars, and it's twice as much as your buddy, neighbor, it has to have a basis. It can't be just an arbitrary decision by somebody. The value of the Prop 218 legislation is, as I said earlier, the fact that it gives us a chance to look at it. The process of actually doing the Prop 218 goes across a period of months. We are right now in the process of securing an engineer to look at this Zone 11A situation and make a determination on how to distribute a cost to individual property owners. This work needs to be accomplished in a timely way. We need to be in front of and with all the information attributed to the properties will be known at that time, quite similar to the hearing that was held for the DWR assessment program. After the meeting and after the hearing, tabulation of the ballots that are cast will be conducted by the county clerk. When we talk about proportional, the simplest way I can think of to make it clear for me is to say that if I'm assessed on the basis of the engineer's program $100 and Gary is assessed $200, I have 100 votes, Gary has 200. So the greater your assessment, the greater your portion of the assessment, the greater the number of votes. I get to cast my 100, yes or no, and Gary will get to cast his, yes or no. A 50% yes vote plus one will pass the assessment. Okay, so it's 50% plus one to pass the assessment. When I first heard this thing, my head was spinning, and it's like, what are we talking about? Okay, so let me review it again. The cost of the project that we would propose and the final budget cost will be divided up through the engineer's study so that each property owner will have a certain assessment levied against their property. The value of that assessment will translate into a number of votes. Each of those property owners will then cast their vote, yes or no, mail their ballot in, and the votes will be tallied after that time. And that's the Prop 218 election. Why is this so important? Well, without the funds, we can't do a project. And if we can't do a project, that means that we're looking at that locomotive being fired up and come back down the railroad at us. Okay? The year timeout that we got doesn't prevent return to Department of Water Resources care. If we do not successfully pass the Prop 218 election, if we do not successfully raise sufficient dollars to do the project that the Board of Supervisors can approve and feel comfortable with, we're right back to square one. So it's very, very important that our committees and our task force continue its work bringing this group together. We then have an opportunity to bring grants and other resource monies to the table and to the zone. If we don't do that, we're on our own. We have to pay the entire cost of whatever is levied against us. We don't want to go there, and you don't want to either. So step by step, the process is continuing, and at this point, we've got good motion, we've got good movement toward a plan that's affordable. And the key on it, as we look at it, is it must be affordable, it must be achievable, and it must be supported by a Prop 218 yes vote. Thank you. Let me turn it over to Linda. She gets to wear the next black hat.
Sure. So what happens if the project is given to DWR, if we're not successful with the 218? What does that mean? It means that they must use their own work plan for taking care of the channel. It means that they must follow the mandate as it's stated in the State Water Code. And if I can break down that section of the water code in one easy sentence, it is, thou shalt maintain the flood control system as designed. There is no leeway for them to deviate from that. They've told us that several times. And if you'll remember that at the Board of Supervisor hearing on June 14th, the representative from the Department of Water Resources was asked about the maintenance activities by one of the supervisors, and he was very clear in saying that they would try their darndest to make sure that they could clean it up, but they knew it was almost impossible to get it back to the original design. So what would happen is they would be charging you more and more and more to try to reach that impossible level of maintenance on it. We would have no control or influence over what the Department of Water Resources would do. We could ask them to do something different, but it will come to no avail. Their response will probably be, we feel your pain, but we are mandated by the State Water Code to do it this way, and we don't have the leeway to do it any other way. Projected by the Department of Water Resources was almost $7.5 million. That's an average for the homeowner of a single-family residence of almost $7,000 for 6 years, and that's a lot of money. That works out to being over $1,100 a year. What's the problem with this DWR cost? Well, for one thing, it's probably going to go higher, and the reason for that is that there's no inflation factor assumed in it, and they haven't taken into consideration the amount of money it will take for them to acquire the permits to do the cleaning they want to do, and the requirements for mitigation, which will probably take substantial amounts of money. If the project stays local, we develop the work plan. The first step was to determine how we could develop new flood management projects that would be environmentally sensitive. Later on this evening, you'll hear Mr. Dvorsky talk about the study which has been done and the measures, and get a preview of the measures that have been identified as potential projects. Projects have been identified both down in the flood control zone and further up in the watershed. Some of these projects will be eligible for funding through grants, as Tony told you earlier. Part of the reason for this is because they've been identified as projects that not only will help reduce the flooding potential, but they meet other important environmental objectives. Many of them will help to improve water quality, they'll improve groundwater recharge potential, and there may even be opportunities to include them in some type of recreational opportunities. Our elected representatives are aware of our efforts. They've talked to us in meetings earlier in the year, and they have pledged to help us once this study was done and we had projects that would be fundable. Costs will be less for those. Our costs through an assessment will be less than those of DWR. And your first question is going to be, how much less? Aha. And we know that that's your question. And I regret to tell you, but the answer right now is we really don't know. We've just received the study. It's a draft.
It's full of information, and it's information that we need to analyze and sort out. It'll take us a few more weeks to do that, because we need to eventually get these figures to the engineer so that he can start his work. But we should have that estimate by the end of the year before.
Mentioned right now is I'll be talking in more detail about the results of this study with a PowerPoint presentation. I plan on speaking for about half an hour to go over all the alternatives, both in the flood control reach and upstream, looking at the environmental benefits and also the sediment reduction measures that we proposed. So hopefully you'll get a chance to stay for that and hear me talk about the report.
Now, we want to really plug that, because John's report will help us understand what that level of funding needs to be. And so I really hope that you stick around for that to get a sense of what was looked at in terms of project options. Because those project options will cost money. And when we figure out how much those project options will be, and we provide a lot more input to the process about those project options, we'll be able to have a better sense of the cost involved in doing those options. So please just stick around. I think it will really help to clarify and let you know what your money would be going for in the 218 vote. So I really encourage you to stick around for that. I didn't see anybody's hand go up in terms of questions. Are there questions out there on pieces of paper with you? We'll run around and grab those pretty quick and try to get those questions to the correct panelists. So this is the time for you to think about what you're wondering about. I know I'm wondering about lots of things. Norm really gets me thinking. So wonder what you're wondering about, and see if you can write that down on a piece of paper, and we will hopefully give that to the panelists that can answer that. Any others?
There's one more.
Okay, here's one. Who, Linda? Here's one for Norm. Go ahead and get started on that so far.
The question I have is, are we looking for a longer time period than DWR? DWR's work program looked to restore everything within the first year or two or three or four. We are looking at spreading out the costs over a 10 to 20 year period. That will then be able to help us keep assessments lower than what DWR would have done.
And those listings were the people that are presently included in Zone 1-1A. Okay? When the Department of Water Resources took a look at the elevations and at the meeting that they held for the boundary hearing, they brought a map that was revised from what the original list was. There were some areas that were dropped out up in the high corner. There were some properties added in the lower portion. There was some more property added out along Highway 1. This is a very generalized kind of presentation. The direct answer to the question is the engineer that's being hired, the assessment engineer that's being hired, will look at the parcel numbers. He will look at the elevations and all of the other criteria that he has to look at in order to determine the benefit that any property will receive. If it's determined that that property is included in the benefit zone or benefit boundary, then yes, indeed, that property owner will receive a ballot and that property owner will get to vote on it. Okay? Did I make that clearer for folks? No? Okay, did I answer the question? I guess not. Want to give me a second stab at it?
This perhaps is a follow-up, and maybe that'll clarify the question that might still be out. Regarding the 218 assessment, do we, the property owner, get an opportunity to review the engineer evaluation, and can we challenge it?
It's my understanding that that's the purpose of the public meeting, that the information is presented, it's out in advance, all of the data will be made available, and yes, indeed, property owners will have a chance to input and be present in that meeting and discuss whatever they need to discuss.
And the question about the boundary line?
Okay. Question about the boundary line is determined by the engineer's study. I don't know the technical process that he goes through and all the details of it. We're going to learn more about that. I think suffice to say what took place before with the Department of Water Resources, as I talked with one of the representatives from the Department of Water Resources, they took the view that if you drew a line from a certain elevation on the levee and took that line until it intersected the elevation of the ground, that that's where the line would fall. And so, indeed, trying to make things come into configuration, but they can use very discrete information, very technically correct. So boundary lines will be reviewed, and people will be notified, and they'll have a chance to participate in public meetings.
The question I have is, we would feel better if we knew about any grants or alternative funding to help us pay. I know of a few grants right now. They are funded through what is called the Prop 50 and the Prop 40 bonds. There are monies for projects there, and they come up in a cycle. Some of our projects would be available for those. We've talked with county staff who work with infrastructure funding, you know, infrastructure being things like bridges and roads, and we're looking at the Union Pacific Railroad bridge there near the 22nd Street Bridge in terms of there are federal and other grants and funds out there available to do infrastructure work, so we would need to identify that and then start the process of lobbying to be eligible for some of those. We also have funds that we might be able to apply for from the California Coastal Conservancy. They help fund this project. They right now are providing a matching grant that is directed toward agriculturalists to do the implementation of best management practices on their agricultural lands. There would be other opportunities through the Coastal Conservancy for projects in this study. And the county has developed what they're calling the draft Integrated Regional Water Management Plan, in which these projects will be identified as actions that the county would like to see taken, or that communities would like to see being taken, so that they would be eligible. Once these projects are found in a plan, then
for us. Along those lines, I know some of you know our assemblyman, Sam Blakesley. Sam's been very helpful, been working right along with us on this. He's got a super crackerjack water guy in Sacramento that we talked to on a conference call, and he listed off a whole long list of potential grant areas that we might be eligible for. Problem is, we've not had an organization that was together or still long enough to to apply for them. The money's out there. We have to just get organized, get those projects defined, and start applying for them. So the opportunity is there. I have a couple of questions here, and I may not be able to answer all of them, but I'll take a shot at it. There's a question here about why isn't the Board of Supervisors held more accountable? They said it was a myth that they were responsible, yet they paid the lawsuits. I can understand the frustration. A lot of us were frustrated when this process started. This whole situation grew out of, I think, a very antagonistic relationship that developed between some of the residents down in Zone 11A and the board and the county as a whole. We could spend a good deal of time, and I know there's probably still a lot of angst out there among some of you. From time to time, I sort of get a little glow going as well. But the bottom line is the county has come around and the board has come around, and what they're doing now is, I think, what we should be focusing on. What they're doing now is working with us. It serves no useful purpose for us to go back and do a shoulda, woulda, coulda. What we need to be doing now is focusing on moving ahead and forward together. I don't mean to discount the fact that we probably, all of us, and including the board, including the county, probably, you know, if they had a do-over, probably would have done it different. But the important thing is where we are right now and where we go into the future. There's another question here about the status of maybe some extra assessments for the dunes. And I'll defer to some of my panel members. Norm talked about the engineering study. And if the engineering study is going to include is the creation of a legal entity in lieu of a memorandum of understanding? And the answer to that question is yes. A legal entity that would be the sole oversight agency for what we're talking about would generally be formed by, unless I'm mistaken, something very formal like a joint powers agreement, which in essence makes them a special district of sorts. Different from a memorandum of understanding. A memorandum of understanding is voluntary. It brings together, if you will, a coalition under a standard agreement. It allows for people to contribute at their own comfort level or capability or desire. And the important thing is that they are at the table and willing to participate. There are a whole long list of issues that come into play when you start forming legal entities versus memorandum of understanding. There's that big L word out there, liability. And that looms large for a lot of folks. Two more L words. Anyway, whatever. What are the details of the proposed sales tax? We want to spend a lot of time on that. What we're proposing is a half-cent sales tax here in the city of Arroyo Grande. And what that will generate for us is a stable amount of money. We're looking for long-term money. We're not looking for a short-term sunset clause in our sales tax initiative that we hope will be successful. Long-term money will give us the ability to leverage money long-term so that we can do some big-ticket infrastructure items like flood control and flood management and flood mitigation. Nice thing about a sales tax initiative as opposed to property taxes or any other kind of tax is that the burden just doesn't fall on the residents of Arroyo Grande. It's all of our tourists. It's everyone who uses our services that passes through town and buys anything from us. So a lot of cities and counties are going to this to do exactly the same thing. The main reason why is because the state funding has dried up. We can't even fix our streets and roads out here because of those transportation monies that just aren't there. So the only other option we have is to take matters into our own hand. But at least it's out on the table, and at least we are addressing it and trying to define it and clarify it. And I'm sure before it's all over with, we'll have more than one lawyer involved. But at the same time, that's what we're moving where we're moving with this liability issue. It is going to come up, and we'll do our best to define it and work with it. And I'm going to do my best to make sure it doesn't stall us. We need to get beyond this. If we all work together, we don't have to worry about the liability aspect so much. Just fix it.
I've got two questions that I'm going to read both of them, and I think they're related, so perhaps I can give a single answer and handle both of them. First question is, why does the assessment only affect property owners in flood zone 1, 1A? Second question is, what happened to costs being spread out to all in Arroyo Grande and Oceano areas. The flood control channel provides a benefit to a specific physical area in our county. Many of us live in that physical area. Probably most of us all do. That's why we're here. The Zone 1-1A structure was established years ago following the creation of the flood control channel. And the purpose of that was to funnel some revenues into the forward maintenance and care of that channel. In the process of receiving the proposal from the Department of Water Resources, it immediately popped up, well, wait a minute, there's a lot more going on. There's a lot more things affecting that channel than just that area itself. We're in the bathtub, okay? We're the drain. We didn't cause the problem, so why should we have to pay for it? Well, we're going to have to step up and contribute something to the process. We don't get a free ride, all right? Nobody gets a free ride. We took a look at going out to the greater watershed area and collecting nickels and dimes from a whole lot of people to raise a whole lot of money. And on paper and in conversation, that seemed like, well, that's the answer. We just go out and get 50 cents or a buck from a whole bunch of people, and we'll have all the money we need to fix the problem there. Well, in order that they all want to buy into and see the wisdom of, because we only have a year to do business before the Board of Supervisors, okay? So path of least resistance, honestly, was to come to the Zone 1-1A area and say, what can we afford to contribute to do more work and more consistent work? It was the conclusion on the part of the task force and the advisory committee that we start and we focus right there at first. And we develop an affordable program that we all can buy into, that we all can make a contribution. We can't get it done with $5. As you've heard, we don't know the total numbers, but we sure as the world can't survive if it's $800 or $1,000. Okay, we understand that. Does that make it clearer for the question writers? Do I see any nods, yes or no?
And I wanted to let Norm know that I jotted something down here that might be helpful. As we're talking about assessments and MOUs and grants, how does it all fit together in terms of taking care of the costs of the projects that you'll be hearing about from John in just a minute? If we look at it and add all together the potential assessments from Zone 1-1A, the MOU participants that Tony talked about, all those agencies and organizations with not just in-kind, like the Sand District, hopefully, but not cash, but in-kind as well. So we're looking at a level of participation up watershed, that's what this means, in addition to the assessments that might come out of 1-1A. And then I think Linda addressed also that grants could potentially come to bear on helping to fund those projects. So all of those together will give us a certain level of flood protection, and you'll be hearing a little bit more about flood protection and what it costs from John. So these are things that we could potentially add together. If DWR is around, this will be big. We heard about that. This won't be possible. It's not allowed for in the water code. And neither is this. Grants are not possible. So if we look at the local control option, then we have the ability, yes, to raise the assessments, hopefully with the 218, but we have these other options to bring additional funds in that we wouldn't have otherwise. Does that help?
Yep. I think so. And one of the features of Prop 218, we're just in discussion, we're talking about formulating a program where if in future years we accumulate surpluses and if we are income to have the goats, to have the vegetation clearing, to do other small projects such as topping the levees and working toward an increase. I've got two more questions. One is, what about mobile home parks? Does the park owner get assessed or the individual homeowners? Do they have one vote or many? This gets down to property ownership. If a mobile home park is owned privately by one single individual, that parcel, that property owner, is the person who gets assessed. I happen to live in a park that's that way. I understand from things I've read that unusual assessments and unusual costs, a park owner has some legal relief that they may appeal and be able to spread those costs to the residents. Doesn't mean that he must or that he will or that he shall, but there's an appeal process that he can use to get some relief if the costs are excessive. The other example of a mobile home park would be a park that's corporately owned. The ground is corporately owned. The residents have a proportionate share of ownership in the park. That's still one parcel or perhaps a couple parcels. Those parcels are the ones that are assessed. That owner, as a corporation, is the one assessed. And the board of directors or that corporation, would cast the vote, yay or nay, on that. Now, what they do with the assessment, whether they divide it up or whether they have a provision within the mobile home park to divide it up, I don't know. That's their decision. That's a process that they have to resolve. Another question is, if you own rental units, does that mean one vote per unit? No. Let me back up and clarify. I'm getting assessed $100. Gary's getting assessed $200. And that's on the basis of the engineer's study on the benefit. Has nothing to do with property value. Has nothing to do with numbers of units on the property. It is a determination of the proportionate share of the cost to do the project. The share of the cost levied against that property. Okay? So, he gets 200 votes, I get 100 votes. And it's determined on the basis of the amount of the assessment that he and I are responsible for. Okay? I see scowls still working out there. Scowl factor is still working. To sit back and do a scratch and say, well, you know, it looks like this. They have to justify and they have to be able to support their findings. Okay? So that's part of the engineering process.
And we hopefully will be able to provide a simplified version so that I can understand it at the public meeting when we get closer to knowing what, you know, the assessment is going to look like. Can you jot that down if you wouldn't mind? I'd be grateful. We have more questions here.
Yes. This one is multi-part, so I will work through it. The county, SLO, had the Arroyo Grande Creek levees built by the Corps of Engineers, who are not liable for their work, for development within the floodplain zone. The levees were built at the request of the property owners. Back in, historically, the creek has always flooded. In 1952, there was a severe flood. It led to a group of citizens saying, enough, we need to do something about this. They formed a resource conservation district, which is the group I represent. They did that 50 years ago. They teamed up with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, which is a federal agency that provides service to landowners. And they worked in partnership also with the county. They applied for a federal grant that is available through what's called Public Law 566 that helps to fund levees for flood control. They were successful. They got the money. The RCD hired an engineer and a construction firm, and they went out and built the levees. Then they signed an agreement with the county in 1959 whereby the agreement was that the county would maintain them, but that the money to pay for the maintenance was to be financed by the property owners. That's back in 1959. At that time, there weren't very many residents down there. You know that in the last 40 years, there's been an additional 30 or 40,000 people that live around here now. Over that amount of time, the assessments have not been increased. So even without an inflation factor, they're fairly archaic in terms of not being able to raise enough money to do the maintenance. Concerns that were raised, and at a point where then in the late early 90s we had endangered species that were recognized, where before the method of choice for keeping the channel clean was to hop in a bulldozer and ride right down the middle of it and scrape everything away. A couple other changes happened. Lopez Dam was built about 10 years later, and it has a constant flow of water coming out of it now, which means there's always a live stream or close to a live stream. It meant that there was no dry period to be able to get equipment in there. Therefore, because of the live stream and because of the fish and other sensitive species concerns, permits were needed. That led to increased costs. Then in 1996, the property, there was a vote by the electorate to instigate Proposition 218, and Proposition 218 says your assessments cannot be raised without your vote. So the only way that assessments could have been raised back then was for the county to have held a 218 vote. I can't comment on that. I don't know why it wasn't done then, and here we are today. We're talking about a 218 today. The next part of the question, well, I think I've answered it. The county has been receiving taxes since 1958. They have been receiving assessments, but they have been spending them. And as over time, the amount collected was not enough to do the maintenance that was needed.
I seem to be the lucky guy tonight. I've got a whole pile of questions. Another one was passed asking, is the assessment partially determined by the value of the parcel? Again, to try and focus this process for you, the assessments that were distributed previously were on the basis of a formula that looked at agricultural land different from commercially developed land. It looked at land such as residential property. It looked at vacant land. And there were values applied to each of those categories of land or properties. Each of those categories carried a different weight factor. They carried different weight. Let's say vacant land is, for argument's sake, is zero, has zero been. So there's a weighting or a value applied to each of these categories of property. And again, it's on the basis, the distribution of the cost is based on those factors and that sort of factor that the engineer will use to determine what my fair share is going to be in maintaining the levy, contributing to the cost. Okay, does that help? Do I see any heads going yes? I see one, there's one. Oh, that one's not asleep. That's good. All right. Thank you.
My question is, why does the California Water Code apply to DWR and not the new local organization? The Water Code has a provision. It's a state water code. It has a provision that says when a local flood control district can no longer provide the maintenance that is required to keep it functional, that the local district has the option of turning itself over to the state. And the guidelines that the state would follow then are in that water code. So the question was, why doesn't it impact the new local organization? Just because we are a local organization, it is considered a special district, or it is considered a district that has a benefit and that it is open to assessment charges being determined by the local group. It allows you to vote on it. The state water code doesn't, the state is not required by the state water code to ask you to vote on it. They just give you a bill. Whereas this way, we tell you what you're going to be paying for.
Okay. Well, there's a another note, I realize it's not written on the form. That question, is there a vote on the proposed boundary change before a 2018 election? I have not read that such is the case. I was just, you saw me thumbing through a packet of stuff here, and that was information on Prop 218 processes. It's my impression that the presentation of the boundary and those affected and the cost to those is a process that's done publicly in advance, that people have a chance to vote this if you want to see me after the meeting. Okay. Oh, all right. I'll be happy to research it and find out. The last question is, why not assess all of five cities? They're the property owners creating all of the runoff into the creek. Why lay it all on the flood zone 1-1A? We hear you. We understand. And earlier you heard Mayor Ferraro talking about the work in the watershed area. Yes, indeed. Development processes have taken place over the years. Land use changes have taken place, and it's put an increased burden. And Mr. Dvorsky has very specific information that you need to stay in here that answers the question of the why and wherefore and where it comes from and what the problems are. So it's all the more important that we get the work done. Remember, Zone 11A, what we're talking about is a process of protecting against flooding. If we don't get this done, if we don't do it and keep it in control on home base, we're looking at state costs, and who knows if they will develop any kind of improved protection for us at all. My view of the dollar that it may cost me, direct or indirect, is that it's a cost of insurance. It's a cost of protection. The bigger scope, the bigger effort is indeed to get cooperation of those agencies and those groups and the upper watershed area to see its part and to take its part. Indeed, that takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of integrated effort on a lot of agencies, a lot of staff at county. I mean, the whole subject is an extreme complex subject. Wish we could wave the wand. Wish we could simply say, yep, you guys got to pay, and be done with it. It just isn't going to work that way. We got to be patient with that reality and do what we should do locally and work toward a bigger agreement and bigger solution to the problem.
And then shall we make this the last one? We are being penalized for a law that we knew nothing about in the water code. When we bought our homes, why weren't the sellers legally bound to declare that this law was and still is in effect? We will be forced to do this when we sell. Is this fair or legal? I don't know the answer to some of that. I don't know why, you know, what determines disclosures in real estate transactions. To take over local districts, and that they worked with legislators in Sacramento, they had to change that code a little bit. It used to be they had no choice. They had to take it. There was no yes or no about it. And now they have the discretion to determine whether they want to take it or not. However, it doesn't. That change in the code does not affect us. Is it fair? Is it legal? I don't know.
Are they regrading? They're regrading right now. Do you know that's what I think?
There was a question about what's going on in Los Barros Channel right now in terms of some heavy equipment out there. And I asked Linda in the RCD, or maybe it wasn't you, but I asked maybe somebody. Oh, I think it was Gary, what was going on. And I really don't know the answer to that. Does anyone have a clue as to what's going on there? And then we're going to take a brief break. Marjorie, you have an answer? Oh, right.
I live right across the street, and I've been watching it happen. And I also belong to the St. John's Lutheran Church, and they are in a building process, and they needed to have the water and the sewer connected to the city. And so they got permission permits to put that under the channel, and that's what they're doing, and they're all finished, and they're cleaning it up now.
So it's part of development at the church. That's your understanding. Okay. I would like to remind you that on November 8th, we will be going before the Board of Supervisors with an update of what you've heard. And we need you again. So November 8th will be the update at the Board of Supervisors. We'd like you to come and be an audience member and be there supporting the folks who will be speaking and providing the update. Show support so that the Board of Supervisors knows that you're there, you're plugged in, you're participating. So November 8th is the day to remember. We'll be starting the morning. I don't know what time we're on the agenda. Do you? We don't have a time yet for the agenda. If you have an email ability, let Julie know what your
part of the efforts of this group. As Norm mentioned, it's a very complicated process, but working cooperatively, this group is very dedicated, and I have confidence that they're going to come up with a plan that the Board of Supervisors can be comfortable with and support. CACHO is supporting and providing county resources where we can, and I've been fortunate to work with this group on the Technical Advisory Committee, and I'm very impressed. You're lucky to have this group working on your behalf for the community. So I expect CACHO to pop in anytime. He seems to have clones and makes it to a lot of things. So you may see him by the end of the meeting, but he did have a previous commitment and is sorry he couldn't come. And please stay after the break also and listen to the presentation on the alternative study. It's very interesting, and I think you can really learn a lot how this will affect you. Thank you.
So please, we'll take a very brief break. Let's try to keep it to about 5 minutes. I know there'll be a long line at the bathroom, but please do stick around for John's report. We'll see you in about five. You're right. Okay. Whoop. Am I on? What you're about to learn more about is a set of actions or options, alternatives, if you will, that arose out of a brainstorming process of the folks that you've been introduced to and a variety of other agency people and technical folks. And those options and actions then were studied by John and are the contents of a report that you are welcome to take a look at. You can view the report. I think Julie can get you copies of it. It's also on the RCD website, and Julie's got handouts to tell you how to find that website. There are copies available.
Developing some of these alternatives for managing flooding in the lower Arroyo Grande Creek channel was a process where initially we went, we sort of brainstormed about all the potential options. So whether they were feasible or not, we put them down on paper. And after we had that entire list of potential projects, obviously we couldn't analyze all of them. So we focused on the ones that we felt were both feasible from an engineering perspective, but also feasible economically. And we boiled it down to a set of alternatives that I'll discuss today. So as an overview, this colors are kind of turning out weird on this, but the assessment area for this report is not just the flood control reach, but the entire lower watershed. So the watershed that accepts rainfall and flow from every part of the watershed downstream of Lopez Lake. So that's our interest area. So that's the larger study area, but then there's a focus study area on just the flood control reach, and that's where we analyzed alternatives to reduce flood risk there. So the study objectives, we wanted to evaluate alternatives to reduce flood risk in the La Cienega Valley, which is the floodplain that's in the lower portion of the watershed. Then we also wanted to look at the larger watershed to reduce human-induced erosion in that area. Because erosion is a big problem in the watershed, and it's causing sedimentation through the flood control reach, and it also has impacts on things like fish and other aquatic habitat conditions. So we wanted to look at everything at once. So for the flood control portion, which is just the main channel, the flood control study area, the primary objective of the project was to evaluate potential flood reduction actions, and in the report it's referred to as alternatives, to reduce the frequency of levee overtopping. So we wanted to analyze at what point the levee gets overtopped and how we can provide more capacity so that more water can go through that reach and not overtop the levee as often. And then we wanted to evaluate the expected cost of each proposed action. And just to, I'm not going to go into costs in this presentation. They're outlined in the report. But I wanted to let you know that the costs we developed, what's the cost of this project and what's the benefit? So we can compare them across all those alternatives and figure out what the best alternative is in terms of cost-benefit. Now, the primary flood study goal was to match the channel capacity of the 1955 design. So we wanted to come up with an alternative that was the most cost-effective, that had the same capacity as the channel did when it was designed in 1955. So how do we define flood protection? What terms do we use? I wanted to provide some definitions here because these issues we're discussing are fairly technical, and I could have provided a technical overview, but I think everyone wants to understand it and how it affects them. So the first thing we do is we base it on historic stream flow records in terms of determining how much water is going to flow down. You know, we can't predict the future, but we know what the past was like. So if we have a stream flow record, which we do on the Arroyo Grande River, or Arroyo Grande Creek, we can analyze that record and then predict how often the flows are going to exceed the capacity of that channel. So in that case, if you have a longer record, you're going to have a more accurate prediction. In the case of 1955, the stream flow gauge was only put in 1940. So they only had 15 years of record, and yet they had to project what the 50-year flood was like. Well, they don't have 50 years of record, so they're estimating. If they only have 15 years of record, 14 years of record, then their estimations of a 50-year flood are going to have a lot of error in them. Well, today, since the gauge was put in 1940 and it's been operational ever since, we have over 60 years of record. So we have a better estimate now of what the 50-year flood would be today than they did back in 1955. So we can readjust those numbers and figure out what the flood control capacity was maybe back then when they built it in the late 50s, and then use that number to predict how much capacity we need today. So flood predictions are also defined based on probabilities or chance of occurring. So when I say a 50-year flood, that means it has a 2% chance of occurring in any given year. So it's similar to the chance of a 50-year flood occurring. When you get to the next year, you still have a 2% chance of that occurring. If you're out 50 years and you want to know if 50-year flood's going to occur, you still only have a 2% chance of that occurring that year. So each year, like I said, is independent from the next. You know, it doesn't remember if a 50-year flood occurred last year. So if you look at a 10-year event, it's a 1 in 10 chance of occurring, or a 10% chance. A 10-year flood, if we say we have 10-year flood protection on the levee, That means we have protection from the five-year event, we have protection from the 10-year event, but we don't have protection from the 20-year event. So just to make sure everyone understands that. So in 1955, and I don't want to confuse everyone with all these different numbers. It's more you just need to understand relatively what's happening here. In 1955, they provided protection for the 50-year event. So right here. That was their design capacity for the channel. Well, in 1955, their predicted 50-year event was 7,500 cubic feet per second of water. So it's a certain volume of water that was going through that channel. That was the capacity. Any more water than that, it would have went over the levee. Well, based on our additional data we have today, a 50-year flood is actually 13,600 cubic feet per second. Now, there's two things going on there. One, like I said, is we have additional data to better predict what a 50-year event is. But also, there's been development in the watershed since the late 50s. So there's more water that goes, once it hits people's roof, it hits their driveway, it runs off into the street and runs right into the channel. So all that additional water is getting into the channel faster, and it's causing higher peak events. So that's an impact, but also we have additional data. So there's two things going on now. The current channel capacity, you know, we did an aerial survey in February, and we did a topographic survey, and based on that, we estimated what the current capacity of the channel is. And the current capacity, according to the models, only was able to hold a 2.8-year event. There's an idea called roughness, and when you use the equations, you use a n value to describe that roughness. Now, all you need to know is that a higher value of roughness, so 0.07 is higher than 0.035. That means that less water can get through this area than can get through this area. So think about if you were walking down the channel here. The roughness is all that vegetation that's in the way. So if you're walking in the middle of the channel, it'd be easier for you to walk down than if you were walking on the side where all the vegetation is. It'd be pushing you back. You'd have to push through, so you'd get through here a lot faster than you would get through here. So currently, we estimated, on average, we measured this all the way down the channel, currently the roughness is 0.057. And the designed channel, the roughness was 0.035. So one issue is reducing this roughness will provide more additional flood protection, and that's one of the alternatives we looked at. The other issue here is there's a concept called freeboard. Now, when you're standing on the levee and you're looking and the water's rising during a flood, an engineer designs this channel so that the flood that they're designing the channel for will be at this level, and there'll be 2 feet before it gets to the top of the levee. Now, the reason they do that is it's a safety factor. And once you get above that two feet there, there's a risk that the levee could potentially fail. So you want to make sure that in all these designs that we're providing 2 feet of freeboard, so it's that extra protection against the levee failing or a log gets jammed in here or something like that. So we're providing that additional protection. So with the topographic data we had, we looked at and we ran a flood down the river. And the point at which it started overflowing was right in this location here. So this is the railroad bridge, and this is Highway 1. So it's about halfway in between on the south side of the levee. That it's the lowest point in the levee. That's where the levee first overtops. So in a five-year event, and these are some photos showing that levee breach. Now, it's difficult to predict where a levee would breach, so our focus was really analyzing the capacity and at what point the levee would overflow. So the flood reduction alternatives or actions that we analyzed, and I'll just go through these briefly and then go in more detail for each of them. Alternative one was vegetation management. Alternative two was sediment management. Alternative three was levee maintenance and raising. And that included, we analyzed three different alternatives were there. One was just raising those low points that we identified in the levee. There's been settlement in the levee and things like that, so it's raising those low points, smoothing it out. Alternative 3B was adding an average of 1 foot, and then alternative 3C was adding an average of 3 feet. Alternative 4, I'm not going to discuss because it was basically a bridge raise alternative, and it turns out we ended up incorporating those into 3B and 3C. Alternative 5 was a concept where we allow the river to flood in particular locations and we control where that water goes. And then we have three different alternatives under that. And then alternative 6 is looking at potentially acquiring property in the upper watershed and allowing some of the tributaries to flood that land so it reduces flood stresses on the lower watershed. So alternative one, this is vegetation maintenance. If you remember the existing conditions, the roughness was 0.057. This alternative, we want to bring that roughness down, reduce it. And the way we would do that is we would keep a vegetated buffer right along the edge of the channel, and then we'd remove all the remaining vegetation on the sides of the levee. And the vegetation that we do maintain within that buffer, we would remove the lower limbs, so it actually provides canopy cover for aquatic habitat interests, and it also reduces future growth of vegetation because it shades it out. But also, removing the branches and things in the lower level provides more flood capacity through that lower level because there's not branches and things obstructing it. So doing this alternative, we went from a 2.8-year protection, which is existing conditions, up to a 4.1-year protection just by removing the vegetation. Alternative 2, we assume that we would remove the vegetation, plus we would implement a sediment management program. And the sediment management program, we would keep the low flow channel and the 10-foot buffers intact. It's when we were out in the field doing surveys, it looks like protection. We go from a 4.1 in alternative one to a 4.6-year protection. So we're almost up to a 5-year protection with these two alternatives. Alternative 3A is the smoothing the levee. So looking at low points in the levee and smoothing it out so we reduce those points that low points where the water is spilling out. This assumes that you do the sediment removal and maintenance, you do the vegetation maintenance, and basically you raise the levees to provide 10-year flood protection. So in this alternative, by just adding height to the levee to smooth them out, we're going from a 4.8-year protection in alternative two all the way to a 10-year protection. But again, this does not meet the goal of matching the 1955 capacity. As I mentioned before, the 1955 capacity was 7,500 cubic feet per second. We're up to 5,400 cubic feet per second with this alternative. Alternative 3B, this, we raised the levee enough to provide 15-year protection. And the reason we're analyzing all these different levels of protection is because the costs are different for different levels of protection. So we want to make sure that we're analyzing the cost versus the benefit of doing each of these things. In this case, again, we'd raise the levees in most areas. We'd still provide that 2 feet of freeboard. Here we're up to 7,000 CFS. We're getting close to that 7,500. That was the 1955 design capacity. But we still haven't reached that. Also, this alternative, because we're raising the levee so much, this alternative requires us to potentially raise the Union Pacific Railroad Bridge. And this is the reason. We got this photo. I mean, we don't have the opportunity to see a flood in action. You guys did, but I haven't had that opportunity. So we had this photo, and this was during the 2001 event. All this debris is piling up against the bridge. The water hasn't piled up against it. The water's flowing under it, but the levee height is right at this elevation, so water would actually start pouring over the levee before it impacted the bridge here, though it's fairly close. If a big tree came down, it might take that bridge out. So we felt it was prudent, if we were going to raise the levees, that we're up to 8,600 cubic feet per second. And that's, again, I want to mention, this is, in today's numbers, 8,600 cubic feet per second is a 20-year event. In 1955, 7,500 CFS was a 50-year event. So you can see there's impacts both in the watershed and also changes in the numbers based on having additional data. This alternative, based on our analysis and in terms of what the Zone 11A district is trying to achieve, this was the most cost-effective alternative. Now, it requires that bridge raise, and there may be other funding mechanisms to raise that bridge, and, but we'll need to see how that works out. So I skipped alternative 4 because it included the bridge raise, but we go to alternative 5. This is overflow weirs and easements. I just want to describe what that meant. So here's the channel. You're looking from the top of it, looking down like you're looking from an airplane. And this is the direction of flow. What we would do in alternative 5 is in the levee we would build some concrete structures that would allow water, once it got to a certain elevation, to flow over those weirs and go into most likely farm fields. And those farm fields would have easements, flood easements put on them. And what the flood easements does is it compensates the landowner for any future impact on that land. They can maintain it in farmland, so they can continue to farm it. But let's say we have a weir, an overflow weir, and an easement that overflows in the 20-year event. So the channel would have 20-year protection, and then water would flow out of the channel if flows were higher than the 20-year event. And they'd flow into a flood easement. So the farmer really, statistically, would only be impacted by one crop loss in 20 years. And then, of course, there's cleanup costs. So we haven't done all the specific calculations to determine what the flood easements would cost, but we made some assumptions in the report. So alternative 5A assumes that we would implement alternative 3A, which provides. I'm going to skip 5B because the results suggest it is not really feasible to do. 5C would actually get us 50-year flood protection. And the way we do this is we assume that alternative 3C is implemented, which provides 20-year flood protection, and then we flood 125 acres of farmland to provide the additional 30 years of protection. So again, any flows above the 20-year flood would flow out into these flood easements. If it's above, and then that would protect all the way up to the 50-year event. So here's a summary of our cost-benefit analysis for each alternative. So the red underneath here is the project cost, and the farm and the flood protection benefit is above it. So as you can see, some of these, the costs increase considerably, but with very little benefit. So if you look from alternative 1 to alternative 2, We don't get much flood benefit, which is the blue bar, but we get the cost goes way up. If you look at alternative 3C, the benefit goes way up, but the cost doesn't keep pace with the benefit. So if you look at a cost benefit analysis, we've determined that both 3C and 5C appear to be the best alternatives to pursue. And it might be that you implement alternative 3C first because that gets you 20-year protection, and then in the long term, you could work on implementing the remaining amount to get alternative 5C to provide 50-year protection. So that was the flooding study. I want to get a little bit into the upper watershed work that we did, and this was focused primarily on erosion. So the primary source reduction study objectives were to estimate a sediment budget for the lower Arroyo Grande watershed and identify a source reduction program to minimize human-induced erosion in the watershed. The primary flood study goals are to reduce sediment supply to the flood control channel. So catch the sediment or reduce the sediment that's being, it opens a whole nother set of grants that you can get to implement those projects. So just to provide a couple definitions, a lot of these are difficult concepts to understand. So what is a sediment budget? And a sediment budget is similar to what it implies. Basically, you're looking at erosion in the watershed, you're looking at transport, which is how it moves down the river system, and then the difference between the erosion, so what's supplied, and then what's transported is the storage. So the storage is what you see in the channel. So you can equate this to your home budget at home, where you have an income, you have expenses. The difference between your income and your expenses is your savings. It's the same concept. Do humans cause erosion? This is a difficult answer to a question to answer specifically. There is natural erosion and there is human-induced erosion. Natural erosion, if we didn't have natural erosion, we wouldn't have the landscape we have today with mountains and valleys. Valleys are caused by erosion of the mountains, incision of those mountains, and the lower Cienega Valley is, or the La Cienega Valley is an example of erosion that occurred in the upper watershed and deposited down in that valley. Human-induced erosion is caused by disturbance to the land. There's lots of different types of disturbance. We've all seen human disturbances. Some of them are temporary, like building a house. You disturb the land initially, and you build your house. Others are long-term. So we wanted to get at what those processes were and what portion is natural, what portion is human-induced. We've done multiple studies, sediment budget studies, throughout the central coast of California, and our numbers suggest that approximately 50 to 90% of all the erosion is actually natural erosion. But oftentimes it's that small amount at the top, and it's often fine sediment that gets eroded that ends up in the creeks and causes impacts. So how can we reduce erosion? Erosion can be divided into point versus non-point sources. Point sources are things like a ditch along an entire, 3-mile section of road. It's not something where you can specifically say, well, that's the spot that it's eroding. It's just something that over time it erodes and provides sediment into the channel, and then that eventually gets down to the lower portion of the creek. Now, we can control these sources. We treat them differently. Point sources, you can go in and fix those actual locations. So if there's a bank erosion, you can lay back the slope and put a revetment there to protect it from eroding further. Non-point sources are a little more difficult. Oftentimes, non-point sources require changes in the way you do things. So in the case of range management or something like that, you know, maybe reduce the number of cows that are on the property, or in the case of building a big housing tract or something, it's putting things to protect, you know, reseeding bare areas after you're completed, things like that. So it's just changing the way you're always doing things. So I just want to briefly go look at some of the results. We did the sediment budget analysis. We used a variety of techniques to figure out how much sediment was coming off the watershed. Now, we obviously can't run around and go to every single location in the watershed, so we had to use some techniques that were both remote sensing. We had to use published rates of erosion and then apply them to conditions in this watershed. But then we also did some field-based estimates to come up with rates of erosion. And our results suggested that in terms of pure quantity of sediment, the Arroyo Grande main stem, due to a lot of bank erosion and things like that, was providing the largest contribution. So that's why it's all in red here. The next most significant source was Los Barrios. And then after that, we had Tar Springs and then Corbett Carpenter Creek. And so those were identified as our highest priority areas to reduce erosion in the watershed. It's not to say erosion isn't occurring elsewhere. It's just the most is coming from those watersheds. So we came up with a sediment source reduction program based on those priorities. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details and the specific projects. That's included in the report. But the basic idea is the bank erosion was a significant factor to get deposited in the upper watershed, then it's not going to get to the lower Arroyo Grande channel. So we want to, and then we want to integrate those with habitat enhancement. Integrated with bank erosion, you could put large woody debris and you can engineer it to make sure it's not going to move, and that provides benefits to fish. And so that provides the nexus to get grant monies for habitat enhancement projects to fix bank erosion sites. So the next program we came up with is these floodplain restoration sediment retention sites. We identified 6 sites in the watershed, and in those sites we evaluated whether they were fish-bearing reaches or not, because it changes the permitting environment, it changes what you can do in that location. In the areas that bear fish, we proposed doing floodplain restoration, where a piece of land is bought, and if there's a levee there, you remove the levee, or you move it so it's on the outside edge of that parcel of land, and then when the flows come down the creek, it floods onto that parcel, deposits the sediment, and you have less sediment going downstream. So we identified mostly in Los Barrios and Tar Springs, those were the ones that were potentially fish-bearing or might have jurisdiction with fish and game. On the other tributaries that we didn't figure had fish, we would do in-channel sediment retention basins. So these are more traditional approaches where you essentially block the creek so that the water backs up and it deposits the sediment, and then the remaining water flows downstream. Those also could potentially have a flood control benefit too, because you're temporarily detaining some of that water, and so it's not affecting the peak as much downstream. And then we had point sources. We had approximately 15 significant point sources that we identified, and those range from bank erosion outside of the main stem of Arroyo Grande channel, so on the tributaries. They also include some areas where there's major head cuts in the channel, and a head cut is when the creek's going along and then all of a sudden there's a steep jump in the creek. Well, what happens there is over time the location of that head cut will move upstream, and it'll excavate all that sediment in the channel and it'll all go downstream. So if you can keep that head cut, need to be updated. If they haven't been updated in 20 years, maybe there's better ways to do it, better ways to reduce the amount of sediment that's coming off the land. A lot of the non-point sources will be addressed through a voluntary education and outreach program. So things that everybody can do on their land to reduce erosion,
there'll be a program developed so that everyone is educated about what those things are. And it would be a voluntary program. There may even be workshops and things like that that people can come to and learn about how to reduce erosion on their land. And this would be combined with efforts to reduce runoff from urbanizing areas. So Mayor Ferrara already mentioned efforts that are going on in the city of Arroyo Grande to reduce runoff from urbanized areas. And so this would be, hopefully if it was successful there, it would be expanded to the entire watershed.
Could you talk into the mic?
Sorry. And so this is my last slide. I just want to mention the draft report is out there. It's on the internet. I think it's on the NRCS website, is that right?
RCD.
On the RCD website. So you can download it from there. I think, is there any copies in the library?
There are copies in the library and at a number of city halls, and there's a list of that
table
here.
Okay. So there's copies out there for you to see, so I encourage you to review it. It is a draft, so hopefully you'll find errors and I can fix them. But what we're requesting is that any comments you have, as opposed to getting on the phone and telling us each of these specific comments, if you put those comments in writing, it's much easier for us to work through each of those comments and send those to Julie Thomas at the Coastal San Luis RCD. And her email address is jthomas@coastalrcd.org.
Okay. Well, that's my presentation. Thank you so much. Hello, ma'am. What's your phone? Copies of the report. Yeah, thank you.
Battery is going dead. Can you go to a hard drive?
At a computer and type out your comments, give me or Julie a call and talk about it with us, and we'll take notes and we'll provide those comments to John. I hope that's okay with you, Julie. The next step, and I want to give a few minutes for John to maybe answer some questions, but before that, I want to let you know that those comments will be compiled and changes will be made, and that final report will be due in December. That report will also be made available on the RCD website and at local city offices and libraries. We'll continue to accept comments for the next 2 or 3 weeks. So please do send those by regular mail, email, and the option is to give us a call. Julie, why don't you put our phone numbers up there, too? And the two things that are coming up, one was mentioned before, the Board of Supervisors meeting on November 8th. We'll be providing an update on the activities for local management. We'd appreciate your attendance as a show of support. That would be wonderful. And then this is another activity I'm about to mention that wasn't mentioned earlier. On November 9th, something called a flood fight training will be offered in the community by the Department of Water Resources staff to teach us various ways to protect our property from flooding. This will be a hands-on course that will include practice and use of sandbags for flood protection. The class is aimed at city and county public works employees, but there are a few vacancies for interested members of the public. And contact Julie if you are interested in participating. So if there are, it's about 10 minutes to 9. I know my bedtime is quickly approaching. So if there are some questions out there with a microphone that isn't quite working, I'm not sure how to do this. If there are questions, would you come up to a mic so that everyone can hear you? And there's one up here. If that one can go live, that would be great. And we'll take a few minutes of questions for John's report only, if you would. Would you go ahead up and stand up here? Thanks.
My name is Bill Keats, and my question to John is, if in one of the alternatives, if the bridge at 22 Avenue Street is raised, what about the railroad bridge that's just further downstream, a couple of hundred feet.
I believe he was speaking about the railroad bridge.
I didn't hear that.
Passport. The 22nd Street Bridge, it appears that that doesn't require raising based on the alternatives that we put together. So we're mostly concerned about the Union Pacific Bridge.
Other questions? He was that clear?
Mm-hmm. He was fabulous.
You were, John. You really were great. Round of applause. There is a lot of additional information on the website, including a recent newsletter for Zone 11A that talks a lot more about the activities that we've all been up to. But I want to take a moment to thank all the folks on the committees that have been hard at work, and I want to recognize Cacho. You're here. For all the support, it really did start with Cacho saying, I wonder if the locals can do it. Let's see. And we're still at it. So I want to thank you as a part of our community for your interest and involvement in this process of developing the long-term local control for flood management of Arroyo Grande Creek. Thank you and good night.